You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
How many discounts does USAA auto insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/auto discounts. Restrictions apply.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365 Copilot.
All right, here we go. Another episode of the How to Hunt Turkey podcast is in progress. And today's guest from Vortex Optics is my buddy, Graham. Graham, how we doing, man?
Good, man. Ready to talk some turkey. It's finally that time of year where I'm really starting to think about it. Yeah. You know, you're kind of coming off of the deer season high and go through that small period where you're like, oh, it's good to be not hunting for like a week or two. And then you're like, all right, we got to get thinking about something here. We've hit that point officially.
Okay. So my first question to you is last week I talked to last week's guest. Like the title, he's so crazy about it. The title of the episode had the word psycho in it because he is like self-admittedly a psychopath. Even in December before deer season is even over, he's taking it to the next level.
Yep.
So between meh, 0 and 10 being, dude, I'm ready to go right now. All I'm waiting for is the date at this point. Where do you land in your excitement level for turkey season every year?
I would say at this point in time, I'd say I'm probably about like a 7 to an 8, and that will ramp up very, very quickly. We're a couple weeks out from the NWTF convention in Nashville that I go to every year. So I think usually once I hit that point and like you start hearing turkey calls, you start talking turkey more, like then it's a 10 all the way through the season.
Yes. Okay. Yep. All right. With that said, what are the indicators? Because here, I'll give you an example. For me, I don't think about turkey very often. And the only time that like there's one thing for me that gets me fired up is when I'm gravel traveling with my son or I'm out on a drive out in the country, maybe even during shed hunting season, I see my first strutter sometime in March off the road. And that's like a switch for me. Yep. I see my first strutter, whether it's near the road or it's like a mile away or through binoculars or whatever. That's my switch. What's your switch?
I'd say mine probably comes a little bit earlier than yours does. I'd say I think I've probably already hit that switch where I'm starting to think about it. And usually for me, it's like when you start putting in tags and you start putting in applications and you start thinking about where am I going to stay? Oh, should I go to this piece or should I try somewhere different? And I mean, even this weekend, I mean, it was negative 40 here in Wisconsin and driving around, I saw two toms in a field. So like just seeing that alone got me kind of fired up thinking about it. So, especially this time of year too, I'm starting to write, like permission letters to people and sending those out. So I'm starting to think about it, starting to be a front topic for sure.
Yeah. I got a question for you, but before we get into that, I'm gonna do a really quick thank you to the partner of the How to Hunt Turkey podcast, and that is Montana Decoy. I mean, Montana Decoy has been around for a long time. Very awesome products. And one of the reasons I like the Montana Decoy turkey hunting decoys is you can smush them together and throw them in a backpack. You don't have to like throw them over your shoulder. It has like this spring system in it. You can bend the head, and it can be a hen head down or a Jake head down, Jake head up, and you can really form it. You can put the tail up, tail down, and you can form it any way you like for the representation that you want out in the field. And so the packability is awesome. The ability to have the really good printed feathers and look from a distance, like Turkey come into it. And that's why I like Montana Decoy. If you guys want to find out more about all of the decoys, especially the turkey hunting decoys, head on over to montanadecoy.com. All right. Talk to me a little bit about the application, because I feel like Wisconsin does it different than a lot of other states in regards to applying for a turkey tag. As a resident, even for here in Iowa, I just go to the store and buy it. You guys have to actually go through an application season. Walk us through that.
Yeah, so it's kind of a mixture of an application season and kind of what you described, depending on where you hunt in the state and the time of the year you're looking to hunt. So the application process is always, I think it's around December 10th or December 8th, where you have to have your application in and you put in what zone of the state you want to hunt and what time period. Mm-hmm. So all of the Wisconsin seasons are broken down. They always start a Wednesday and end the following Tuesday. And then the Wednesday, the new season starts. So folks will pick which zone they want to hunt in the state and which time period, and you put in an application. And certain ones are harder to draw than others, like zone two, which is kind of the southeast part of the state. Those generally sell out almost immediately. Those are generally gone. A lot of stuff in the northern parts, you know, they're less desirable just from like a turkey hunting numbers and population standpoint. Mm-hmm. But so you apply and then you find out relatively quick what you drew. So like this year, for example, I drew zone one, season A. So the first season that you can hunt, which I always like to do, get out there as fast as possible here in Wisconsin. Sometimes it's nice to not get those though, especially if you have like out of state plans. Mm-hmm. But once you figure out what you draw, they always do a bonus draw, which any tags that are left, you can go in and apply for. And that happens, I think, generally like mid-March. But then there's generally leftover tags. So specifically for like this zone one where we are, you can pick those up in the later parts of the season. So like mid-May all the way through Memorial Day, like you can pick those up day of if you wanted to, just because there's an ample amount. So there is a limited amount of them, but generally they don't sell out just because of the sheer number of them. Gotcha. So it's kind of a mixture of like an application, but also depending on the time, you could also just pick it up, walk into the store and grab a tag.
Gotcha. So southeast part of Wisconsin, in between Milwaukee and the surrounding areas, and in, you know, obviously Chicago, you're talking about a higher population of people. Thus, those tags tend to sell out quicker just because of the population of people.
100%. Yeah, I was going to say, usually, like, once that bonus tag goes up in mid-March, there's usually not any zone twos left after that. Gotcha. Whereas like zone one, I mean, there'll probably be 15,000 tags left after that bonus draw. Okay. So plenty of opportunities to hunt turkeys for sure. And it just also depends on how much you're willing to travel too. Like some of those zone two people, like if you live in Madison, the zones kind of split Madison almost right in half. Mm-hmm. Like you could hunt zone two, go east, or, you know, get a later season, go zone one and go west. So
gotcha.
Plenty of opportunity there for sure.
So in the bonus draws after you said that there's a potential that around 15,000 tags are available. Does that mean that you can go get another tag for a different season and hunt multiple birds in the same zone?
Yep. You for sure can. So I think the rule is, if I'm not mistaken, you can only buy one tag per day. Okay. So like I couldn't sit there and I couldn't buy 100 tags for, you know, season C in zone one. So you could buy like probably up to 6-7 tags for a specific season. I mean, if you feel like you can get on that many birds, more power to you. But yeah, it just kind of all depends. But yeah, I mean, you can buy as many as you want. I mean, relatively as a resident, they're not super expensive either. So I always like to have them in my pocket, and if I use them, great. If not, it's a good donation to turkey programs, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of like how that works. It's almost like Iowa's antlerless does, and mm-hmm. it's allocated by county, yep. where For example, in the county that I live in, the doe tags sell out instantly and there's no leftovers. The county that I grew up in, however, had, I believe, 1,100 tags this year that did not get purchased. So maybe 800, something like that. So that means if I wanted to, I could go shoot a deer and then I can go buy another tag, shoot yep. a deer, buy another tag and go back and forth until I wanted to stop. Is that how it is, or are there any limitations with that?
I mean, as long as there are tags available and you're going with the one per day
yeah.
purchasing amount, you could certainly do that. Yeah, as long as they're available still.
Yeah. So my next question is, why do you have a job in April?
I get that question a lot, believe it or not. My wife also asked why we're married in April and May. Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate enough, like the nice part about where we're at is there's a lot of hunting opportunities really yeah. close to my work and my home that yeah. I can, you know, even, you know, the day's sunlight cracks earlier. So like I can go out for an hour or two mm-hmm. before work, like before I got to get the kids to school so I can get that done. So yeah, usually I'll have a couple out of state trips, which obviously takes time away from home, but as much yeah. as I cannot impact work and home
yep.
but still also turkey hunt yep. so it's kind of like it's a given, like if it's a weekend and I have a tag, like you probably won't see dad until 11 or noon and then he'll yep. come back,
there you go,
so and then I'll come back with donuts and make everything better, you know.
There's exactly yeah. exactly, dude, it is crazy. This is a side conversation, but my youngest son, he's a second grader, he was in a horrible mood the other day and he got a donut. I can't believe how fast a donut can turn a kid's mood 180.
It's a magical thing. It's a magical thing. Like same thing. We live really close to a Quick Trip. Mm-hmm. And if the kids are kind of having one of those mornings where it's like they're a little bit slow to get out of bed, you know, they're not listening great. And be like, hey, we can get donuts on the way to school. And then immediately like, all right, let's get into gear yeah. a little bit, you know?
Yeah. I'll be completely honest, Graham. I think a donut has changed my mood a couple of days as well as a full-blown adult. So, yeah.
I mean, there's something about just like a good fresh donut and like some yeah. coffee in the morning. You're just like, okay, bingo. All right, bingo. Here we go.
Bingo. What is your go-to post-turkey hunt meal?
Oh, like something I'm making out of turkey or just like something like I got to get some energy.
No, you've been hunting all morning.
Yeah.
You know, you probably have coffee in the thermos. Maybe you didn't have time to eat on the way to the yep. woods, or you did or didn't, and then you've hunted all the way till noon or one, and now it's time to go grab a meal. What's that post-hunt meal?
Yeah, it's usually something very healthy, you know. It's yeah. just something that I put a lot of prep time into, like a fresh salad I make. I mean, honestly, like if depending on the day and like how the hunt's going, like yeah. swinging through Culver's and getting a quick Butterburger, something like that, yeah. like just get back on the road.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, there's been plenty of times where I like get back home or like I have a day off of work and I'm hunting around home and I'm like, I don't want to make anything. Like sometimes I'll just fire up a dehydrated meal, just chow yeah. that down quick and get back out in the woods.
There you go.
Yeah, usually it's not a glorious meal during turkey right. season. It's usually just about what do I need to survive to there keep go. Going one more day.
So for the longest period of time, we had this little mom and pop restaurant and I like fully packed. It could probably hold 15 people in it. And it was in a small town called Oakland Mills. Okay. And the town just barely exists today. And I don't think the restaurant's there anymore. It went through several owners, but they had something called the River Wreck. Okay. And it was, you can just imagine what the title of a river wreck and how many yeah. calories are in this thing.
I'm already in.
Yeah, exactly. You don't have to convince anybody. It was hash browns. Then it was your choice of meat, whether it was sausage or bacon laid yep. over top of it. Then it was eggs on top of that. Then it was biscuits on top of that. Then it was the gravy of the biscuits across all of it, right? And of course, your choice of toast, and then you would crush that, and then you'd go back out into the woods, and then you'd fall asleep for a couple hours before you started moving again. So
let's say you're sleeping, you probably got some bubble guts going on.
Yeah. Dude, I don't know how many turkey seasons I've walked out of the woods with only one sleeve on my t-shirts.
So decisions were made.
Exactly. Oh, and that's awesome. That's the reality of turkey hunting. That's nothing glamorous about it. That's the reality of it.
Yeah. So you got to do what you got to do.
Exactly.
Sacrifices need to be made.
Exactly. Does Wisconsin, I know you got a couple kids, does Wisconsin have a dedicated youth season, or do they have to go through the same process you do?
Yeah, so kind of both. So they do have a dedicated season. So it's the Saturday, Sunday before the opening weekend, mm-hmm. Or before that opening Wednesday.
Okay.
But the nice part is, so you can buy them any tag throughout the rest of the year. So like, let's say I bought my daughter like a Zone 1 Season C tag, because that's what she was able to get. Mm-hmm. So that'd be for like the kind of end of April, early May timeframe. Mm-hmm. They use that tag for the youth weekend. So if they fill a turkey, they just fill that tag. But if they don't kill a turkey during the youth season, then they can use that tag whenever theirs is for the regular season.
Okay.
So they buy, basically they just have to have a turkey tag for any point during the season, and then they can use it during that youth weekend.
Okay, perfect. And it's similar to Iowa. Iowa does something, and that's across all deer hunting and turkey hunting.
Yep.
I buy them the youth tag, and that youth tag is good as long as there is a season open for it. So if I buy a youth tag and my daughter goes out on first season and tries to fill a tag and doesn't get it done, she can then go second season or third season or whatever season's open to go do that. And I think that law is amazing to get kids not only just dedicated to a youth season, but then saying, hey, if you don't get the job done, we have 5 more weeks of turkey hunting that you can go out and try to get it done.
100%. Yeah. And I think too, especially for when it falls in Wisconsin, so that youth season is generally like second weekend of April, somewhere in that time frame. And in Wisconsin, like, it can be very cold that time of year. So like, if it's freezing cold, like, I'm not going to make my kid suffer to shoot a turkey. Be like, hey, we could go if you want to. Maybe we'll do an afternoon hunt, you know, something where it warms up a little bit. Otherwise, here's your season. Let's go then. Just, I mean, the more opportunities you can get them out there, the better. So yeah, I like that structure.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Absolutely. Okay. How many states as far as turkey are you hunting this year? Just Wisconsin or more?
So I'll do Wisconsin and Minnesota for sure. I have applications in Iowa and Kansas, so I'll find those out probably within the next 2 to 3 weeks if I drew those. And depending on what happens with those, then it becomes a little bit more of a scramble, like seeing if I want to go somewhere else that has like an over-the-counter option. So those 4 potentially right now, potentially some others.
Gotcha. So that's a lot of states in a turkey season. And when I think of a turkey season, I don't think of a season like a deer season that's multiple months long. And you know, turkey season,
you gotta start, man.
I know, right? But turkey season to me is like April.
Yeah.
So but it's more than April, it's May. And then I know in Wisconsin, like, it ends the first weekend in June. Is that accurate?
Yep, depending on the year and how the season dates start. I mean, I think the latest I've ever hunted, I think, was June 1, fell on that Tuesday, which was a big deal that year because everybody's like, I want to kill a June bird. But yeah, most of the time it's that like end of May, potentially the beginning of June, depending on when the season starts that year.
Okay, I gotcha. Yeah, I guess you could compare that to like a deer hunting archery season in the state of Iowa going a little over two months there. Okay. So how do you plan that? What are the logistics of a multiple state turkey hunt, in a short period of time, and balancing the wife and kids and balancing work?
Yeah. The big thing is trying not to be gone like multiple trips in a row. That's kind of the key thing there. So at least if you're coming home for like 3, 4, 5 days in between trips, like a lot of times that's enough to kind of ease emotions and get your work done and all that good stuff. So really, I mean, it comes down to season dates too, which is generally why I try and apply for some of these states that I do. So like
Iowa, for example, I applied for the first season there, which is going to be, I think that's a week or two full weeks before the Wisconsin opener.
Okay.
So like, it gives me opportunities before our things start getting hot and heavy in Wisconsin. Yeah. Same thing with Minnesota. Like, I'll generally try and do that one, like, that first, maybe second week of May, just because that's when things are really kind of getting fired up there. And it's nice and close, so I can bop there. And even if it's for a long weekend, right? If I go a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I'm home Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then hit the woods here in Wisconsin. So it's really just trying to plan out date-wise where things line up. And look at those opportunities where you can get going early. Like the one that always comes to mind, and I've never hunted there, is Florida. Like Florida, they open up like beginning of March. And I always try and we always do a family trip down to Florida a little bit earlier than the kids' spring break for school. And it always lines up with their turkey opener. And every year I'm like, you think I could sneak away for a day? And it's always like, no, this is a family trip. But like even down south, like they open earlier. So like if you really want to maximize your turkey season, like find those ones that open up before your home state does and just get after them, right?
Right.
And like a lot of the times I find I hunt better at home then because you kind of knock a little bit of the rust off too. Because like those first couple times you're out there, it's not going to be perfect. You're not going to be the best you are all year on the call. You're not going to, you know, have your woodsmanship down on like how you should walk and like reading turkey's temperament. So it's kind of like, okay, let's get some stuff moving. Let's have a couple practice rounds. You know, hopefully you get a bird or two down and then you come back home and you're dialed and you're ready to go.
Right. Okay. So you've hunted multiple states. I like asking this question to guys who've hunted multiple states at different times of year. Obviously, different times of year means different types of or different amounts of vegetation, whether that's big woods like certain parts of Wisconsin and Minnesota, or ag country like certain parts of Wisconsin and Iowa. And then obviously the South is different all across the board. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about, from a turkey hunting standpoint, maybe turkey temperaments, turkey behavior, similarities and differences in different states that you've hunted.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, honestly, most of the turkey hunting I've done is in the Midwest. So like Minnesota, Iowa, I've hunted Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, obviously, Nebraska. And I would say it's so tough because a lot of these birds in this general area are going to have, every bird's different, obviously, but similar temperaments. Yeah. And I would chalk it up more towards, at least in the states that I've hunted, time of year versus like actual area, which is why I really key in on, like, especially hunting here in Wisconsin, like that 1st of May through like the 20th. Like those are some of my favorite days to turkey hunt, like that window.
And why?
Because reason being is a lot of the hens have been bred at that point and aren't going to be super receptive. And a lot of the males are still seeking pretty hard. So they're not putered out just yet.
Yeah.
And like that time of year, like I'm even fine sleeping in the morning. Like don't hunt them off the roost. Like get in there on 10 o'clock, hunt 10 to 2. And if you can get a bird to gobble in that time window, I think your odds of killing them are pretty dang good. So like, I mean, it's nice. It's casual. The weather's nice that time of year too. So you're not, it's not sucking to be out there. You know, it's nice. But yeah, if you can get a bird to gobble in that 10 to 2 window, like generally I'm in the chips. Like I know he's at least going to play with me for a little bit. And more than likely he's alone and he's going to come.
Dude, that's interesting because I've never done that. Yep. I have always done the opposite of what you've just said. And a lot of it has to do with my own schedule.
Yeah.
And that was get into the woods as early as possible, get relaxed, and then try to kill them right off the roost in the morning. That's how I was taught to turkey hunt. That's how I've always turkey hunted. Why specifically at that time of year do you like to wait to get into the woods until 10?
Yeah. And a lot of times, like, I'll even go out in the morning, but I mean, same thing as you, like, that's kind of how I was taught. Like, that's when you get out there, that's when they're gobbling. And I think that's a really cool time, especially when you take somebody new out, like, hey, listen to the woods wake up, listen to these birds, they're going nuts. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, like, they're not alone when they're flying off the roost. Like, maybe it's an unpopular opinion, like, killing them off the roost is not easy. Like, it's tough. Cause I mean, generally they're going to be with other birds. more than likely there's going to be hens around, mm-hmm. and they're going to fly down. And if you're not where those hens want to be or can cut them off, like you're out of the chips right away. Right. Like there's one property that I hunt specifically that they roost kind of right on the edge of it. And they, all the hens fly to the neighbor's ag field. Those times felt like to kill one in the morning on that property is very tough. Yeah. I've killed a lot of them in the afternoon and kind of around that like lunchtime period though. So generally being like, if they're flying down and they're getting with hens right away in the morning, like they're going to go with her, they're going to breed her probably throughout the morning. And then those hens are going to go and they're going to lay on their nest. And those toms are still going to be fired up and they're still going to be looking. So if you can catch them coming off of that, like you can have a lot of success in that middle time frame for sure. Yeah. Like the nice part about that too is like if you don't hunt the morning, like as you know, you can get up, you're at home, you can get the kids to school, and then you're like, yeah, I'm going to go bomb out for a couple hours, you know?
You explaining it that way makes me want to go try that method of hunting. Like, because I always feel this. I always feel like I get up early. I go bomb in during the best, you know, the gobbling period. And then most of the time, unless I'm in the path of where the hens want to be and the hens go by me or brings them in, mm-hmm. that a lot of times toms are moving away from me, or maybe I'm overcalling, or they're in a position where they can see into the field where I'm calling from, and they don't, you know, they don't see anything, so there's no need to come in.
Yep.
And if I go in at a later time, they're already kind of, you know, worked up. They do their thing, and then the hens kind of break away, knowing that they're not, the toms know that they're not receptive. That might give me a different. This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. A different view, and from a business standpoint, allows me to get work done in the morning, yeah. before I head out.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, like I said, like killing them off the roost is not an easy thing. It's the popular mm-hmm. thing to do for sure, because right. you're going to hear a bunch of gobbles. You're probably going to see birds. You're going to hear birds for sure. Mm-hmm. But if you're not where they want to be right away, or if there are hens in the area, like it can change things really fast. And then more than likely you're going to sit there until probably, you know, 8 o'clock or so, yeah. which is about the time they'd probably start breaking up in the next hour or two. And you're going to be back at home having coffee, yeah. where you could have been doing that already. And the nice part too is you can just be very efficient. Like I'll drive to properties and like park my truck, go in, let it kind of calm down a little bit, do a call, like sit there for maybe 5-10 minutes, do a couple calls. If you don't hear a gobble, next property, like go.
Yeah.
Because more than likely you'll find one that's fired up and then you know you're in the chips, right? So you're not kind of yeah. sitting there and committing to one specific spot in the morning, you know?
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving. Princess meeting and greeting. Lightsaber clashing. The Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping. Banshee flying. Space Mountain launching. Galaxy rewinding. What is the point of galaxy rewinding? Fireworks igniting. World of other worlds. For whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth. Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Yeah. Talk to me about that. Wherever and whenever you pull into the property, whether yep. it's private or public, that to me, that doesn't matter. you pull into the property and you start the process of deciding whether or not you're going to go in and chase turkeys or not. What does that look like?
Yeah, so it depends on the property. Like, I've got a pretty good bead on, like, a lot of the ones that I have access to on the private side, and then there's a lot of good public around here, too. So, I mean, generally what I'll try and do is at least get, you know, 50, 100 yards into the woods, depending on the property and what's available, mm-hmm. and, like, get to a really good point where you can listen. And what I'll do is I'll do a couple soft calls right away just to make sure that there's nothing super close that I'm going to bump. Yeah. And if that doesn't work, I get super aggressive, super loud, just to see if I can strike something up.
Yep.
And then once, you know, if they gobble and I can get a bead on where they are roughly, then it's game plan time. Let's figure out how close we can get. Because at that point, I want to close the distance if possible as much as I can. Because, Dan, I'll be really honest with you, I am not a great turkey caller. And neither you don't have to be to kill birds.
Yeah.
So, like, where I think my strength is figuring out where they are and being very aggressive and, like, popping that bubble and getting close enough where even if it's, like, a light call, they're going to come in and at least check it out.
Right.
So, yeah, it's really property dependent. But, like, try and get to a point where you can listen, do a couple soft calls, make sure that there's nothing super close because, I mean, they could be – right over the ridge and, you know, right. gobble and have you shaken because they scared you so bad.
Right.
And then get really aggressive with it. Wait for 5-10 minutes or however long you want to give this specific piece. See if there's anything that's fired up. If not, don't waste your time. Go to another property because somewhere there's a bird that wants to play ball.
Yeah. So that's a great point. Let's say you go real aggressive. You strike one up, but he's not close. He's not that turkey that's close. He's yep. down. As you're closing the distance and being super aggressive, are you continuing to call at that bird, or are you not wanting to expose yourself and just trying to get into that bubble, like you said?
Yeah. So, I mean, yes and no. So I'm not, like, as I'm walking, I'm not calling or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So generally what I'll try and do is, like, pull up a map and get a rough idea of where I think this bird is. Mm-hmm. Gauge a distance and be like, okay, here's how far that I want to close. Like, if I can get within 150, 100 yards, mm-hmm. that's pretty good. So, I mean, just be careful walking through the woods. Keep trees in between where you think that they are. So, obviously, mm-hmm. time of year changes how you use that terrain, too, with foliage. But try and be really aggressive there. The only time, like, I would call making that initial approach is if I'm like, I'm really not sure where he is. Like, this terrain looks different. Do yep. a soft call to see if you can just get him to fire up again. But an important piece with that is I always make sure that I'm standing in front of a tree and, like, in a general spot that I feel good that I could set up in. Mm-hmm. Because if I call and he's 75 yards straight away, I'm sitting down right there. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't want to call too much walking in just for the sake of I don't want them closing too much distance as I am. And then we run into each other and yeah. game over. Yeah. So when you do call, though, like, be prepared to sit down in case they have closed that distance, too, and they're coming.
Yeah.
Because that's the worst thing
I don't do. I've been caught with my pants down a lot.
And I have, too, and I forget who I heard that from. But, I mean, probably the past 4 years, it's really changed how I've turkey hunted. Because before, I'd just be standing in the wide open, chirp, chirp, chirp. It's like, oh, bye. He's gone. But it's like, if you get yourself set up, like, in the mindset of I can sit down right here and I can have shot angles and I'm set up in case he's coming. Mm-hmm. And then you just have to kind of slump down into that tree and get in position and you're ready to go versus right. a mad scramble, you know, throwing stuff around, you're kicking leaves over and pushing out branches. So it just kind of helps you change your mindset a little bit of like, you're always in the hunt no matter what, you know?
Yeah, I gotcha. All right. So now you strike up a bird, you're closing the distance, you're working in, and now you're inside of that bubble that yep. you talked about. You sit down, you start calling again. He responds. You're in that bubble. How are you working him for those final X number of yards to get him within shooting range?
Yeah, and that's the million-dollar question because we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but every bird is so different. Their temperaments, their interests. Like, I have no idea if he's got hens up there with him or not.
Right.
So I tend to lean on the lighter calling side of things.
And like sometimes depending on the bird, like if he's up there and I can just tell he's spinning, he's gobbling his head off, but he has no interest in my calls, I'll just shut up. Mm-hmm. And I'll just scratch the ground, you know, make some scratching. Cause sometimes that's enough to draw them in. Yeah. And then it's so, you know, situation dependent, but depending on the bird too, like if you sit there for 45 minutes, an hour, and that bird has not budged, like you've pulled out every trick in the book. You've tried being quiet. You've tried getting aggressive and they're just not moving. Sometimes you got to force the issue a little bit. Yeah. And that's where you're like, okay, I see this tree 5 yards, 10 yards in front of me. I'm going to crawl to that.
Yeah.
Go up a little bit closer. Cause eventually you're going to get to a point where it's either going to happen or he's gone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of one of those, you got to take every situation as it is. I like to be lesser on the calling side of things, go lighter, because I've made that mistake of overcalling. And I mean, I think everybody does, right? Like, especially when in the morning when they're on the roost or when they first hit the ground, like, oh yeah, it's cool to get them to gobble and fired up. Yeah. A lot of times it does more harm than good. Right. So like light calling, scratching, I think is an underutilized tool by a lot of folks, especially if you're in the timber. Like sometimes that's all it takes for them to come in to within 50 yards or to where they can see that area. And then that might be enough to get them to commit and come look harder. So,
yeah,
definitely just kind of play it and like go off what the turkey's thinking. Sometimes like there's been times where I've done one call and they come marching in and that's all it takes.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, let me back up just a second. How much effort or energy do you put into trying to roost a bird the night before you go out and hunt?
Yeah. Depends on the property. Out of state hunts, I put a lot more priority on that just because you're on a limited time frame. So if you can figure out where they are in the morning, even if you don't kill them off the roost, like, you know, generally where they're going to be.
Yeah.
So I'd say out of state a lot more important. And then it's really property dependent too, for me. Like there's a couple private pieces, that I've had access, and like historically the birds are roosting in the same general area. So, and they kind of do the same general thing. But there's a lot of public pieces here that, like, they could be anywhere. So if I know I'm going to hit one of those in the morning, I'll go out, you know, that night and see if I can roost them. And at least, if nothing else, it gives me the confirmation of there's birds here, whether I have that specific location or not. Which is another thing, too, I think, rather than roosting birds, I think another underutilized tactic is just kind of walking in at gray light. Right. Like, I feel like a lot of people, they'll go in pitch black, you know, hours before. And I think if you have a bird roosted and you know exactly where he is, that can be very efficient. If you're going into a property, though, where you don't know where he is, and a lot of times, like, you're hunting public, you don't, go in kind of that gray light area, like, and just wait. Listen for them to start sounding off and then move in. Like, don't touch your call. Don't sit down anywhere.
Right.
Just be set up in a spot where you can move to where those birds are. Yeah. Which, because, I mean, I've seen it before, like, they could roost in one spot of the night, and generally they're going to be pretty close, but they can bounce around from tree to tree during the night, depending on what's going on. Mm-hmm. So, like, going into that gray light and just kind of playing it as it goes, I think could help a lot of people out, too. Because, I mean, if I don't know where a bird is, and it's pitch black out, and I'm walking in, I could be walking right underneath him. He knows I'm there. He's not going to gobble now, and he's going to go the exact opposite direction he just saw me go.
Right.
So,
I don't know how many times throughout the course of my life I have gone in, whether it's been dark or even closer to that, you know, the gray light time frame, where I've been walking into the woods and then all of a sudden the tree above me just explodes and turkeys are flying everywhere. All right. So this is kind of a blatant plug for Vortex. But one thing that I've done is I will wait until you can't see anything on the ground yet, if you're, you know, if it's on the ground or in the timber. But one thing you can do is you can see the difference in the silhouettes of the tops of the trees versus the skyline. Yep. And you can, I always like to throw my binoculars up and scan that to see if there's any turkeys moving around or roosted on the fence lines or anywhere that I can see up into the trees at a distance before I move in. And what that has taught me is historic data. Like, I've noticed through doing that, scanning the treetops with my binos, where turkeys have been in the past, And then it tends to be every day or every 3 day cycle I go in there, there's going to be a roost tree that I've identified that I just stay away from.
Yep.
In the mornings. So I know what access route I need to take in to get to it, maybe creep over top of a ridge and sit in there, as not to disturb those roost trees. And, they don't see me walk in. So,
to your point, like there is one specific example I can think of. I was hunting this piece of public and it kind of laid out, there's this little chunk of woods and then an open field and then a finger of woods that kind of paralleled it a little bit. And I was walking in, I've never hunted it before. And I was coming around the corner and like something in my mind just was like, I don't know where these birds are. Like, let's just hang out here until that like gray light situation, see if they can sound off.
Yep.
And right around the corner where that finger of trees was, all of a sudden like gray light comes up, they start gobbling. And I look over there and there was no less than 25 birds in this group of trees. And I'm like, thank God I stopped, because if I would have rounded that corner, like, I was out of the chips. I would have blown them all out of there, and I ended up killing a bird that morning.
Yeah.
So sometimes just sitting there and waiting, letting the woods wake up on its own, like, and that's the other thing too. A lot of people that I've hunted with, they like to get in there and they'll call before birds are woken up to be like, "Oh, that's your one gobble," and you're like, "No. Let them wake up on their own."
Right.
Like if you walked into my house and started hollering and yelling, like I'd be pissed. Like I'm not gonna go over by you. Like what the hell? So it's kind of like, just take your time. Let them wake up.
Yep.
And then you can kind of get a game plan based on that.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I have kind of learned myself is I always like to start off with an owl hoot. And my owl hoots are dog crap because I don't have a call. I just do it with my voice. But I'm not owl hooting until I hear an owl hoot. Mm-hmm. And I'm not calling at a turkey until, well, I don't like off the roost, usually if I can get them to gobble or a natural gobble, or you start to hear the birds start to chirp and stuff like that. And it wakes up naturally. Now, if it's quiet, then I'll call after like a certain amount of time passes. But right off the roost, I don't really want to call until I hear a turkey. I'm not going to turkey call until I hear a turkey. I'm also not going to owl hoot until I hear an owl hoot. And usually I get that progression enough to start using my calls at that point. So,
100%. I mean, let everything go naturally. I mean, that's going to benefit you the most. And I think, you know, talking about like hearing the turkeys wake up and them start talking themselves, like, I think that's something that a lot of people need to do more is like, obviously everybody's focused on toms during the spring. Mm-hmm. I have learned so much from getting really close to big roost trees and listen to the hens wake up.
Yeah.
And like how they communicate, because I mean, everybody wants to do the big yelp call right away and like, okay, they're going to be coming now. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's not how hens, like it's very soft. Like you hear the tree yelp, slang around there and like that type of call. But I think a lot of people don't realize how quiet they are until like it gets going. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can put off a tom pretty quick by being too aggressive with those calls in the morning, because that's not what they're used to.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I kind of want to go back to your calling methods in different times of year. How does your calling method change from the first, let's just say youth season in April all the way to the last part of May when the season closes? Does it change at all?
I'd like to say no, but I feel like it does at some point. I mean, I feel like I approach every hunt very similarly with like starting off soft and then just kind of reading the temperament of the birds.
Right.
I mean, certainly like in the beginning part of the year, I'm not going to be as aggressive with the calling just because like the breeding season's just starting to kick off, you know, where it's probably not, you're not going to have that aggressive of turkeys. Whereas like you get a little bit later, okay, now the guys are fighting for those last couple of hens. You can get a little bit more aggressive with them, but I'd like to say like it keeps generally the same as like I approach the hunt and then just figure out that situation and that specific bird and what's going to work for them.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers. For a rich, delicious experience, whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
But I guess, like, looking back, like, I probably tend to get a little bit more aggressive in that, like, beginning to middle of May portion. Yeah. Just knowing that I can probably get away with it.
Gotcha. Okay.
If that makes
and
sense.
And then, yeah, yeah. And then decoying. Are you a decoy user?
I have. Yes. Again, very situation dependent. So I've got a number of decoys. I don't hunt a ton of fields. So generally, if I'm in the timber, I don't use a decoy, which I have those Montana decoys, which are super packable, which I like because I can put them in. And if I do get in a situation where a decoy makes sense, great. And if they just stay in my backpack, it's not weighing me down at all.
Right.
So like there's a couple properties I've access to that the fields make sense and decoys will work. But like I've had decoys kind of spook some birds at points. So it really kind of depends on the situation. Like most of the time I really like hunting in timber and getting close to birds that way. I have a lot more fun doing that. And yeah. I feel like you can be a little bit more aggressive with that. So typically in those situations, I don't use decoys. But I mean, I think they're a tool that has a time and a place, like everything else, like every call in your backpack. They're a tool and it just depends on the situation and when you need to use it.
Right. Okay. When you hunt, are you hunting solo or do you run with a hunting buddy where you're able to do setups or do you go your own? Like what I mean by setups is, you know, your standard here, a gobble, one guy goes in, one guy stays back and calls to try to pull them through you. Like yep. Those types of setups.
Yeah, I would say majority of my hunting is solo.
Okay.
So like even on some of these like out of state trips, like Iowa, I'm looking to go with Eric Barber from here.
Yep.
So like even on those trips, like sometimes you'll hunt together, but a lot of times like just to cover ground, be like, hey, you go here, I'm going to go here. Yep. So even though like you're hunting together as a group, like you're going to potentially different properties or different areas of the properties, yep. Just to kind of maximize what you can get done. And even around here, like we'll get together and like hunt as a group, but kind of similarly, like we'll kind of split up a little bit or go in pairs. And it really just depends on the hunt. Like, are we sitting on the same tree? Does it make sense to have somebody drop back? You know, if this bird's getting stubborn and call that way, We had a good hunt with Eric. It was Eric Sawyer and I. God, this probably was 21. And we roosted this bird the night before. We knew where he was. And we're like, somebody's going to kill this bird. And we basically just made a triangle around this bird.
Surrounded him.
Like, I mean, essentially, and we're just like, someone is going to kill this bird. It's like we've done a couple setups like that. But yeah, just kind of depends on the situation. But I'd say 90% of probably the time I'm probably solo.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Does your calling change between a solo hunt or a buddy hunt?
Depending on the situation. I know that's kind of the cop-out answer I've been using, but I mean, it's so situational dependent. Like,
you're right.
If I know that I'm always the type of guy too, like I would rather see somebody else shoot a bird. So like, if I know hopefully we're not working the same bird, but I know if that's a potential, like I'll be a little bit softer with my calls and just see if they'll filter that way. Yeah. Or like depending on the situation, like if we're sitting on the same tree, like we don't need to both be calling. Right.
Right.
So just kind of figuring out like, okay, who's running the call. And like, if I'm hunting with Eric is a phenomenal turkey caller. Like Eric, you're running the call, man. Like go for it.
So let's say like type of calling doesn't really change. Then obviously like the only time that would change is if you're doing that like drop back type situation, mm-hmm. right? Because then you're trying to pull that turkey closer, like imitating the hens leaving. And so he's going to come and check out or, you know, hopefully work a little bit closer. But yeah, other than that, I don't think it changes a ton, again, depending on the situation you're in.
Okay. Now, you said it's hard to answer some of these questions because it's so situational. I get yep. that. So let's talk about some situations. Tell me about a situation where you're going to call and you're going to be aggressive. And then on the opposite side, tell me a scenario where you're not calling at all. You're done calling, but you're still in the hunt.
Yeah. A lot of that depends on the hens. Like if I know there's hens in the groups and I can hear like a boss hen kind of chirping quite a bit, I'm going to get very aggressive with that hen and I'm going to try and piss her off to bring her over. Mm-hmm. And then Tom's going to be in tow more than likely. So like, that's a situation where I'm going to be very aggressive with calling and I'm going to cut her off anytime she talks. And I think you can do that with Tom's as well. Like if you get a really aggressive Tom and he's responding pretty heavily, like you can cut him off.
Yeah.
Call over him like sometime and then get really quiet with it. And that's going to get him like, oh, was she talking to somebody else? And he's going to yep. come marching in. Yep. So I think it really depends on the vocalization of that specific turkey or the group of turkeys. Like,
right.
man, if you can piss off a boss hen and she comes marching in and she brings, you know, 15 to 20 turkeys, like it's going to get chaotic. There's a lot of eyeballs on you, but like that's one way that you can ensure she's bringing a Tom or a couple of them with her.
Yeah.
And then as far as like being quiet goes, like a lot of times, if the birds are responsive, but they're not moving. Mm-hmm. So like, if I know that one's just kind of in an area and he hears me, I know he hears me, he'll respond to me or at least give me a courtesy gobble, you know, every couple calls, I'll go quiet. I'll go 30 minutes without calling.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I hear that gobble from him, from not from a call, I know he's interested and he's checking to see if I'm still in the area.
Gotcha.
And then I'll get even quieter with it. Like I might be working away or just do a scratch that hopefully he can hear just to entice him enough to be like, okay, she's still over there. She's not talking to me. Did I do something wrong? Should I go over there and check? And hopefully that just pulls him right over. It's very situational dependent, but it's those turkeys, they'll have different temperament. I mean, it's similar to deer hunting, right? Like you rattle at a buck, he might come stomping right in and posture up at you. You might scare him to the next county. Like you just got to kind of read the situation and figure out what you can get away with and what's going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. What is your goal every turkey season?
My goal, I'd say, is always to fill every tag that I have, which is a tough goal, especially with how many you can buy in Wisconsin and out of state hunts. But I'd say usually if I get four or five birds in a season, I feel pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's wind this episode down by you telling me what your gear list is. Like, talk to me about your firearm. Talk to me about your optic. Talk to me about what slugs you use, like your vest, like the camo, like your boots. Like, run me through your turkey gear list.
Yeah. My gun is nothing sexy. It is a gun that was passed down to me from my grandpa that I've made like a dedicated turkey gun. It's an mm-hmm. old Winchester Model 120 Ranger. I think like they were kind of like the economy version of some of their other guns out at the time. And he won it at a banquet raffle type thing in the 80s. And it got passed down to me and it's been the gun that I hunt with every single year. Yeah. So I had this, I mean, it looked like a Frankenstein gun before, but I had this saddle mount on it and I put a red dot on it and it worked great. Yeah. But then I had it drilled and tapped this past year to fit that new Viper shotgun dot that mm-hmm. we have. And then I've got a TSS choke in it. So running TSS, and I mean, it's got a long barrel on it. And I mean, the gun is pretty deadly at some serious ranges, like 50, 60, like no problem. That gun is on. And I mean, even further than that. So, I mean, it's not the like nicest gun out there. It's not the lightest gun. It kicks like a mule, but it's one of those guns, like, you know, knowing that it was my grandpa's and like, that's going to be the gun that I grab every year. Like, dude, I've thought about, you know, we have the debate internally every year, like, should we get the new shotgun? And every year I'm like, I have it in my cart and I'm like, I'm going to buy this thing and I'm still going to pick that gun instead.
Right.
Like, right. I'm not going to do it.
Dude, all good turkey guns are passed down for some reason.
Yep.
And it's almost like, dude, I started off with a turkey gun that the stock was loose on it. And me and my uncle joked around and called it Excalibur. It was like this old sword, you know, it's an old sword from mythical stories or whatever. It's the sword in the stone or whatever. And dude, I killed so many turkeys with that shotgun. It blew my mind, and there was nothing sexy about it. Dirty, scuffed up.
Yeah.
And so I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah. I mean, it's long, it's heavy. And like, I mean, you shoot it once and your shoulder is bruised. Like there's nothing protecting you, but it's like, it's never treated me wrong. And then like, it's grandpa's gun. So like, that's going to be the one that I'm going to use every turkey season until,
absolutely,
you know, God forbid something happens to it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, as far as other gear goes, I've tried wearing turkey vests before. I'm not a turkey vest guy.
Okay.
I have always ran a backpack, and I like having a backpack, right, wrong, or otherwise. That's always been what I've run. So I've got the Stone Glacier Avail, which is kind of like a smaller backpack of theirs. But I mean, it's enough to fit a couple decoys in it. You know, if you want to throw snacks, water bottle, whatever you need, you know, a couple trimmers if you got to trim some shooting lanes. But the nice part too is it has this like back flap that you can hoist gear in. So like if you're deep in the woods on some public or something, like you can put your turkey in this little flap, cinch it up, and just walk right out with it on your back. So I've always been a backpack runner, right, wrong, or otherwise. I've tried a couple vests, and I think they're good for like specific hunts. But when I'm just running around and throwing gear around, and like sometimes I want it on, sometimes I don't. Backpack's just been the way, because generally what I'll do then is I've got the Vortex chest harness that I'll run, and I'll keep all my calls in that. I've actually got this old Hunter Specialties pot call that I can cinch into my vinyl harness, so I can have all my calls right here. So that backpack gives me the ability, if I want to have backpack and bring all the gear, great. If I just want my calls and my binos, I can do that instead, or you know a combination of the two. Every year I try and go as minimal as possible with gear, just because I want to be as quiet and as fast as possible if needed. Yep. The last thing I want is, you know, something dragging on the ground or whatever. Or like you're bouncing it around, you got loose stuff in your pack. So I try and keep a pretty dialed kit for the most part.
Yeah.
The one thing that I have liked, and it kind of gives you the option to have the convenience of a vest with like being able to ditch it if you want with a backpack. FHF has this one, it's like a foldable seat that I was able to attach to that Stone Glacier pack. So you can still have that seat cushion if you want, fold it down, or you can cinch it up. Or if you don't bring your backpack, you're just rolling as is and sitting on your good old butt. But I try and keep a pretty light pack overall. As far as camo goes, like, I love the Kuyu attack pants for turkey season. Mm-hmm. And the big reason is the side zips on them. Like, they're a super durable pant. They're quiet. They're really nice in that front, but they have these side zips on them. But the nice part is, like, rather than some other side zip pants that I've used in the past that are open, these ones have like a mesh. So like, you don't have to worry about ticks if you leave them open. Whereas with some of the side zip ones that are just open, it's like, it's an open gateway for ticks to just hammer your thighs, and you're like, great.
Yeah. And that's for ventilation reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. So especially warmer, like when you get into like those May timeframes and you're hunting midday, where, you know, it could be in like the high 60s, like even potentially low 70s, and you're running around, like, you just do that, dump some heat, stay cool. But then if you don't need it, you just zip them up and you're nice and toasty. And then for a top, like, I'll do a mixture of different camos. I'm kind of like a chameleon. I've got a bunch of different stuff that I run. Yeah. Like, I've been running that last year, that Woodsman series by Mossy Oak, their bottomland camo.
Yeah.
I was running that quarter zip. I've run a couple Kuyu quarter zips. I generally like just like a lightweight quarter zip hoodie with like a couple base layers. That generally keeps me pretty versatile. And like, if it's a really colder hunt, I'll have like a lightweight jacket or something in there. But I hate bringing gear. I like, even when I'm deer hunting, like, I hate having stuff and like packing stuff in bags and wearing things that I don't need. And I hate being hot. Like, if I get sweaty, I'm irritable, I'm pissed, I want to be done.
Yeah.
So it's like, I got to run cool.
Yeah. And that's the crappy part about certain times in April, where it can be 30 degrees in the morning in April and you're bundled up. And then the second that sun comes up, you're sweating your balls off. And then you got to find a way to pack all those layers around, you know.
And so, yeah. You'll get a kick out of this one. Eric and I hunted Minnesota once, and we as their first season, maybe first or second season, but it's in April. And like, we were sitting out there and snowstorm. I mean, like pounding snow. It was maybe 20 degrees on the warm side. And we had this like little dinky motel room that we were staying in, and we get back. And I mean, we were not prepared for this weather. We were shivering. We were so cold. And Eric's like, man, I got to crank the heat up. I'm like, do whatever you got to do, man. Like, I'm freezing.
Yeah.
We go to bed, and I wake up in like 2 a.m. and like all my clothes are off. I'm sweating my ass off. And I look at Eric, and like, Eric's the same way, just like on top of his covers. I'm like, Eric, what do you have the heat set at? He goes, right now it's 87. And I'm like, Eric, I'm medium rare right now. I am medium rare. So yeah, that was, to your point though, like April, like you don't know, it could be, you know, 50, very comfortable, or you could get hit with a snowstorm. You don't know. Right.
Do you have any go-to mouth calls, pot calls?
Yeah. So I run a couple different mouth calls. I use some of them by, I'm trying to think of the exact model, by Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls. And then also some of the Woodhaven calls.
Gotcha.
I've got a couple different mixtures there that I use. I'm trying to remember the name on, so I've got a very old slate call. Like, it was potentially the first turkey call I bought. I can't remember if it was the first or second.
Yeah.
But I mean, nothing fancy. It's not a crystal call, anything like that. Just a typical slate call, but it gives you the best sound. And I don't know what it is. It's got a little bit different design. Like, it's on like a tilt. I think it's called Full Tilt. I forget who made it. But it's essentially got like a tilted design for the slate. And then a flat bottom. So I don't know if that helps with the sound or not. But man, like, I've had a couple guys in the office touch it, and they're like, how much do you want for this call? And I'm like, it's not for sale.
Not for sale.
But yeah, I mean, it's nothing special. But yeah, Full Tilt. I want to say Quaker Boy made it, but I don't think that's right, way back in the day.
Okay.
But man, it gives such a sound. It's like one of those sentimental things, like same thing as Grandpa's gun. It's like, this is my first turkey call. It works great. It sounds phenomenal. Like, that's one of my most prized possessions.
Here's the real question. Do you carry a small piece of sandpaper with you at all times during the turkey season?
Yep. Okay. I've got a little pocket. So like those little, the clear little plastic doohickeys that mouth calls typically are in, like the protective cases. I'll usually have one of those in my pocket that's got a couple different pieces of grit paper, couple polishers in there, just to have them in case anything comes up if I'm running a crystal call or anything. So those are a must have in there, especially knowing how terrible I am on a mouth call. Like, if I lose a friction call, I'm in trouble.
Right. My favorite is this. This is how bad I suck at using a diaphragm call. And that is when on multiple occasions, the other turkey hunters I am with just tell me to shut up. Like, dude, you're no longer allowed to call for us. Like, you can do anything except a diaphragm call. You're not allowed to do with that anymore. So
yeah. And every year I always have really good intentions of practicing more and getting better with them.
Right.
And I do, but I just generally don't get better with them. Mm-hmm. I'll usually always have one in just in case, like, I have a bird come in and I got to make a noise hands-free to get him to put his head up. But that is not my main source of calling by any means.
Right. Right. I got a story here that's going to make you laugh. My favorite is, dude, I worked this bird leading up to this, that season, I had a diaphragm call. I bought a brand new one. I was practicing it in my garage. I was practicing it in my truck whenever I was driving around, and it was turkey season. And I said, dude, I'm going to use this mouth call more. And I always start off with the box call and then maybe mix in a slate call. And then this tom starts coming in, and I'm starting to go soft on the slate call until I know he's coming in. Oh, I can see him. And he's kind of strutting in the background. And I'm like, okay, well, I got to start getting him closer. He's coming in. And as I'm starting to position in my mouth this call to start to softly just, I want to whisper to this. It just, and then I spit the mouth call out of my mouth because I put too much pressure behind it. And he puts his head up and runs away. And I'm like, that's why.
Yep.
That's why I don't use a mouth call anymore.
Yep, that is why. Which one of my rules is like, unless I'm getting him to put his head up, like if I can see the turkey, I'm not calling anymore.
Right.
Like he knows where I am. If he wants to come, he's going to come. Like I'll do some scratching or whatever. Because the only thing that's going to happen if I call out that turkey and he's within vision of me, something bad is going to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nothing good happens there. Yeah.
There you go. Well, I tell you what, Graham, man, I really appreciate you, sharing your process with us today. Thanks for taking time out of your day to hop on and BS with us. Good luck. No matter how many tags you try to fill, hopefully you fill them all. Good luck. Be safe. And thanks for your time today, man.
You too, Dan. Appreciate you.
Yep. And I just want to say a real quick shout out to everybody who has been listening to the How to Hunt Turkey podcast. Thanks for doing so. If you could go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever you download the How to Hunt Turkey podcast, leave us a 5-star review, make a comment, subscribe, all of that stuff. Also, be sure to go to YouTube and subscribe to the How to Hunt Turkey YouTube channel as well. There's going to be some more content coming out on there. So good vibes, everybody. Be safe and good luck this turkey season.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Don't chew on that, Max.
Cooper loves that chew, too.
Oh, now he's into Cooper's food. Wow, he is loving it. What do you feed Cooper?
Blue Buffalo Life Protection Formula. He never leaves a crumb. I love it because it's made with high-quality protein, nutrient-rich fruits and veggies, and wholesome whole grains.
Looks like we're switching to Blue.
Blue Buffalo foods are made with the superior ingredients your dog needs to thrive. Can your dog food say that? Visit feedbluefood.com to learn more.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.